For great-looking t-shirts, hoodies, and sweatshirts, the TNT Shop is now open at tntradio.live. Discussing the politics of the new European populism, Pella Nuroth-Taylor on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pella Nuroth-Taylor Show. Into our second hour, we are going to talk very briefly about what's going on in Russia with this Crocus investigation. Well, it seems as if the Russians are turning on their own country or their own security services and their own policing as regards what's went on, moving away the focus from what's going on, blaming the Tajiks or the British or the Ukrainians or ISIS or whatever. And that to me shows you that there is actually a debate that goes on in Russia, even though the British, the Daily Telegraph insists that the Russians are all living in gulags and have no freedom whatsoever. There seems to be quite a lot of criticism that's going on. And I think that the, I'm just trying to find the quote here. The Russians were, the Russian parliamentary magazine talked about the dangers of overstating the risk that it was just the British. And they were not mincing their words on Putin or the Russian security. It's very interesting because we assume that there's a sort of polarized debate in the West, in the UK, and one of them assumes that, you know, we do everything bad, that 9/11 was a false flag, and that the Russians and the Chinese are innocent. I mean, I've never held to that view. I think that there was a paper published a few years ago, I think, in an American political science journal that looked at the number of coups and interventions that have happened since 1945. And it came to a statistic which I regard as quite plausible. And that is that about 2/3 of the coups and interventions came from the West, knocking out other countries. And but 1/3 of them were Soviet. So they're not innocent, but they're certainly not as bad as what the Telegraph and the Guardian, the New York Times will tell you, which is 100% bad things from the Russians and our own things we don't talk about. So this might be a case where the Russians did do something. For what purpose, I'm not quite sure. Maybe it's to, we've got a special military operation going on in Ukraine, and the question is what's going to happen next? Is it going to become a war? Is Russia going to declare war? Do they really want to get their hands on Odessa to close off the possibility of Ukraine continuing to attack the very vulnerable naval base at Sevastopol on Crimea and control Ukrainian grain exports? And it's a Russian historical city. And of course, Macron has said that he's going to put French troops in and go into direct conflict with the Russians if that threatens to happen. And I guess there are some pro-Western voices in the Kremlin saying, well, we've got to listen to that. We don't want to escalate. And then the people on Putin's right saying, well, sod the French, and they won't, and the British doing these things to us. So let's create the pretext that will allow us to escalate. So a third possibility is that, first possibility is it's a Western stroke Ukrainian ISIS attack. Second is it's a sort of Russian state-sponsored attack and the third is that it's something to do with the private actors. There's a very rich billionaire who owns this shopping center, I think of Armenian extraction, and he put out a very large insurance policy on it, and he's going to get a big payout on it. And so, you know, with goons, there are 13 to a dozen in Russia or Tajikistan, you know, you could just hire these guys and maybe set fire to it. And it sounds very similar to what happened in 9/11, of course, when Larry Silverstein, whatever his name is, took out a huge $1 billion insurance on the asbestos-ridden Twin Towers. And then, of course, they collapsed mysteriously, you know. Is it one of those things? There's one of three. It's interesting that the Russians are debating. It's all over the Russian Telegram channels. And their main issue is that there are very little policing immediately afterwards. The Russian police didn't. There was a police station right next to the Crocus shopping center. There were security guards around the place. They didn't go to the secure place where they could find weapons and fire back. And the sprinkler system apparently didn't work, according to some commentators. They saw nothing going on there. So what was just a shooting event turned into a fire event, and that's where most of the people died. So, you know, it's all up in the air. And there's a guy called Edward Slavsquat, who I had on the show last week, And he is under his real name, Riley Wagaman. I could recommend you going back to that show because he's a great Muscovite expert. But go on to him on Twitter because he has all the sources to the Russian Telegram channels discussing that. And they'll talk about much more about details, names and places and so on. Anyway, that's that. It shows you that there is a debate going on in Russia. It's not just a monolithic place. And they are quite critical of their own responses. But it does also feed into the narrative that maybe Putin has been weakened by this, that the Russians are growing a bit suspicious of his ability to defend the motherland, which is part of his part of the reason for his support. Anyway, we've got another news analysis with Basil Valentine, a political editor, and we'll get that very quickly after a quick break. This is the Pelle Nerov Taylor Show on TNT News Talk.
Your voice heard here.
The government needs to step up and do its job.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Imagine, Pelle, imagine how the Western political media class would be acting if Russia or China was bombing and starving a walled-in population of 2 million, half of them children. Seriously, imagine the rage and vitriol. Imagine the non-stop media coverage, writes Caitlin Johnston on the X platform. Imagine how the Western political media class would be acting if Russia or China tried to present them with blatantly fabricated evidence of crimes committed by the targeted population in justification of their atrocities. If Russia or China was doing what Israel is doing, entire presidential campaigns would have been built around who would oppose it most aggressively. Every sanction and embargo in the book would have been slammed upon the perpetrating government. The Western press would be falling upon all over themselves to expose every atrocity, every lie, and blaring those expositions as feature stories on every platform for months and showering one another with awards for doing so. Instead, we get this. Government officials babbling non-stop about Israel's right to defend itself and how this would all be over if Hamas didn't keep fighting while showering Israel with weapons to help continue its atrocities. And if I can pivot quickly to another aspect of the situation, genocidal biomatter is being used in the construction of the so-called aid piers and docks in Gaza. The rubble from the destroyed homes of Palestinians is being used as the hardcore to build the piers, one of which work of celebrity chef Jose Andres has already been completed. The State Department-linked Spanish celebrity chef has emerged as the US government's preferred conduit for aid to enter Gaza following the Biden administration's decision to suspend funding to the enclave's main supplier of food aid and education, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. I mean, the employment of a celebrity chef who has built a pier out of the rubble that includes the bones of murdered children. We're in an episode of Black Mirror, aren't we now, Pelle?
Yeah, and that phrase, genocidal biomatter, I mean, Israelis will find it hard to live that one down. I mean, you know, they've used all this language about the Holocaust and so on is coming back to haunt them, basically, I think, because they've told us we've never allowed to that. We in the West have never been allowed to live that down. And I guess it's all a bit of karma there coming back to them. But I mean, I think this Israeli thing, I mean, I want to get a political development on that, and I'm just wondering what the result of what's going on at the UN, because isn't that the solution, that the whole world unites behind the UN and the UN puts pressure, and if Israel persists, maybe there'll be some kind of domestic blowback, because I mean even the Israelis are sensitive to world opinion, or do you think that's just impossible?
I'm afraid they're not sensitive to world opinion. That's the key thing. I think they might have been 30 or 40 years ago. I don't think they are anymore. Netanyahu has come out just in the last day or two and said, as a warning to Hamas, don't think for a moment that international pressure is going to stop us carrying out our assault on Rafah you know, and continuing the massacres, basically. Netanyahu cancelled this planned trip to Washington, which was basically to tell the United States exactly how they're going to carry out the next phase of the operation, even though the U.S. Didn't veto the latest ceasefire resolution, but has nevertheless reassured Netanyahu that the fact that it didn't veto that resolution means there's no, doesn't mean there's any change in policy. So the Americans really don't know what they're doing or what they're saying at the moment. Meanwhile, State Department officials are resigning. Well, a State Department official, Anel Shaleen, has resigned midway through her two-year contract, saying it's impossible to carry out human rights work while this is going on. She's a foreign affairs officer in the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights and Labour. Meanwhile, you know, people are killed every night in bombing raids, dozens of people killed, people starving to death. And you wouldn't know it if you heard the Western media, which was Caitlin Johnston's main point there, you know, the atrocities.
And propaganda is repetition, you know, and we're not allowed to.
Yes.
We're the I mean, you just have to go to X to find out examples of what's going on. And one was where an Israeli soldier admitted that they'd shot up the UN headquarters for distributing food aid, you know. And so
yes,
this was just the thing is, we're so conditioned, I mean, into the BBC news ident, that, but that's like almost like a religious ritual. I mean, religious rituals indoctrinate us into accepting a certain amount of information. I mean, we call it mumbo jumbo, but when we go into church and the priest begins his incantations and it's habit and it's custom and it's trust, well, that's exactly what we do when we switch on the BBC and we sit there and the somebody said to me that those BBC idents are actually created by behavioral scientists to lull us into a sense of almost semi-hypnosis, you know? So we get all that and we're used to it. And then we're in another stage of accepting information. But it was, when it's just there on an X casual YouTube video, X Twitter, we're not conditioned to accept it as the same. But when you actually analyze what they're saying, it's really shocking, isn't it? So there's, but because the mainstream media don't pick up on it, we're not, it doesn't affect
us. Well, that's
us so
right.
Much.
I mean, aliens could land and take over, but if it isn't on the BBC News at 10, then it hasn't happened. It's as simple as
that's
that.
That's right. You don't have that Hugh Edwards, whoever his name is, with his voice that conditions us, the voice of the nation, you know,
that's right.
The tilt of the head.
The beating drums in the background. Boom, boom, boom.
That's right.
The sort of
the words BBC, which you just said, I mean, have conditioned us for generations. The enormous goodwill, enormous collective part of our culture that when it's on the BBC, it's true. Almost anything is that's incredible.
Meanwhile, the Gaza Media Office, who don't have the same worldwide access as the BBC, say the Israeli army has killed 200 civilians at the Al-Shifa hospital over the last 10 days. The siege of the hospital is still ongoing. Now, if you can imagine, you know, 200 civilians being killed at and in the immediate environs of a hospital anywhere else in the world, bar perhaps sub-Saharan Africa, where such a thing could happen without it being a worldwide headline. Certainly if that was happening in the Ukraine, let alone in Europe, or even for that matter in South Asia or the Far East, it would be all over the news. It would be the number one headline. It would be constantly in front of our eyes, this extraordinary, you know, bloodthirsty situation. But, you know, you have to dig around on Al Jazeera to find it out.
Well, Al Jazeera is increasingly emerging as a kind of the only semi-mainstream voice that of the big, big broadcast channels that has something to say about Gaza, because the BBC is still leading on that Baltimore bridge, which had 6 fatalities or something. But I mean, it's incredible, 200 fatalities right next to a hospital. I mean, what's the justification? Why is this going on? But the Jews themselves said evil has no justification. It just happens. You don't to try and explain it is to kind of forgive. To understand is to forgive, someone said. And sometimes you don't need to forgive. You just have to condemn. And that seems to be a case here, is it not?
Well, you know, we've got a long way to go with this situation, unfortunately. You know, when it's over, are people going to be held to account for war crimes? That's one of the key questions, really. I mean, this catalogue of atrocities gets ever longer. Is anybody ever going to give the remains of the people in the rubble heaps that have been used to construct this jetty, the World Central Kitchen? Andres's organization has built a jetty out of rubble that contains human remains. You know, at some point, is that jetty going to be dismantled and a fingertip search for human remains undertaken, as was the case with the rubble at the World Trade Center, for example, where people got their families' bits back in bits over the course of several years when identified by DNA? I'm afraid to say I very much doubt it.
Anyway, I'm just surprised that the International Criminal Court can't do something. I mean, they indicted Putin for bringing children out of harm's way in the pro-Russian perspective. And here is Netanyahu killing far more children than anyone's ever done in any recent war. And his country's entering the Eurovision Song Contest in 5 weeks' time or whatever. Anyway, it's amazing our double standards. As the West, it's the rules-based order, but it's really our rules and not universal laws or UN legislation. Anyway, that's Basil, we'll talk further tomorrow on Good Friday. But we're now going into our third interview of the day. This is Pelle Neroth-Taylor on today's News Talk. Back after a quick break.
TNT's Mark Morano.
And there's a whole history of this idea that the establishment, the powers that be, the regime in power, likes the idea of a little eco-terrorism to keep the population hungry. I mean, if you think about it, their policies, government policies of the Great Reset, Net Zero, Climate Agenda, are quite literally eco-terrorism or a form of terrorism. It's, as Jesse Jackson used to say, it's economic violence, it's economic terrorism. Jesse Jackson used to say that about the Reagan administration. But in this case, it's the intentional collapse of energy, food, transportation, free speech, all to achieve and make us safer and give them more power under the auspices, if you will, of a crisis.
Mark Morano on today's News Talk, TNT.
The Lights is Britain's far-right conspiracy theory paper spreading hate and vicious lies. No, that's what the BBC say. The Light is the only national newspaper bringing you the real news and informed opinion on what's really going on today. You can subscribe, order copies, submit articles, and read back issues on our website, thelightpaper.co.uk, and see for yourself why the establishment are so worried about the uncensored truth getting out to people every month. The Light Paper. Not far right, just right so far. thelightpaper.co.uk.
Our next steps to space.
This time we go back to the moon to learn to live, to work, to invent, to create.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on TNT News Talk. Now we're going to go back to Trump and the election, which never fails to interest, never fails to be important, because this is an absolutely crucial election. And in the larger context of this election, we're going to go back into history a little bit and talk about Watergate. Now, you remember Watergate is probably the big event of post-war American history, apart from the Kennedy assassination. The link to the Trump is the fact that many people know that Trump was targeted by the CIA and the FBI during his presidency and made it impossible for him to be the proper chief executive of the United States. Not that he was a perfect guy by any means, but they made it worse. But was this the first time the CIA and the FBI have done bad things to our elected leaders? It was not. So we've got to go back to Watergate, which happened in 1972. I remember it well. It was, I remember the social and political aftermath of it quite well. I became a journalist because I watched that famous film, All the President's Men, with Robert Redford in his shirt sleeves, looking sort of handsome and very clever, and saving the world from the evil Nixon, who was a tyrant and surveilling everyone around him and just generally bad guy. Well, it seems it wasn't like that at all. And we're going to be talking to James Rosen tomorrow, who's one of the top experts on the topic of the Watergate revisionist story, who's going to tell us it was very similar to the Trump takedown. We've got another expert on today called Per Colson, who used to work at Fox News as a producer, and then Al Jazeera as their top producer, a journalist of 30 or 40 years experience in the top news bureaus of the world. Welcome, Per.
Hi, Pelle. Good to see you. Talk to you again.
You knew James Rosen, so he's a friend of yours and you've worked together. But you're going to tell us a little bit about Watergate from your perspective, because you've actually followed Nixon all your life and the Watergate scandal. So I'll just throw it out to you and we can have a kind of dialogue about this, because I got my own views. I mean, I've worked, I wrote a mini book on Watergate and Kennedy. Do you think it's true to say that it wasn't what we think it was? I mean, was it a takedown of Trump, do you think? I mean, of Nixon?
Well, I think that when you think about this, there are so many incredible similarities between what is happening with Trump today and what happened to Nixon back in the 70s. But let me just tell you one story. You mentioned the movie with Robert Redford. I had dinner once with Ray Price, who was Nixon's key speechwriter. He wrote Nixon's resignation speech. And I interviewed him once when I was working for Fox. And after that, we got together a couple of times and we had dinner one night. And he said to me, you know, did you realize that Robert Redford contacted Woodward and Bernstein to make a movie? And this was before Nixon's resignation. So even before they knew what the result would be, they knew that they were going to do a movie, a big Hollywood movie with Robert Redford. And of course, that sort of conceptualized the whole story for the two journalists and drove them to keep going in a certain direction. And I think, as you know, of course, what happened with Watergate is also very interesting in terms of who were behind the bugging of Watergate. And Price continued to be really upset and angry with the deputy head of the FBI, Mark Felt, who, as we now know, was one of the key sources to Woodward and Bernstein. And of course, from his point of view and from most of the people close to Nixon, what happened to Nixon was essentially a coup d'etat organized by high-level influential members of the intelligence community. And they managed to...
It seems if we were cut off there briefly, we'll see if we can reconnect with Per. What I can almost fill in the sentences there, and I'll talk about it, because the official news story is that Nixon hired these guys called the plumbers to surveil the Democrats, and in an unconstitutional way, and they had their headquarters in the Watergate complex in Washington, which is still a prominent building. It's newly built back then in 1972. And the Democrats had their quarters there, but nobody was there because they were all down at the convention in Miami, I think it was. So already that should have been a warning flag. But anyway, in June 1972, they broke into this almost deserted office and placed a bug there to spy on the Democrats. And that was sort of the thing that sparked it all, because it was seen as a local felony when the police discovered these six men who broke in. And it was seen as a kind of local cop, you know, local arrest. And then it sort of snowballed from there. And I think Woodward, who's America's one of the most famous journalists in America, who had a background in intelligence, covered it as part of his local beat. And then, you know, clues were sort of there to allow him to expand on the story and trace it ultimately to Nixon's nefarious planning of the whole thing. But it seems, I mean, now these revisionist books, including by Rosen's that we've got, and in interviews like Per had with Price, shows that in fact that the CIA actually had their hands all over the robbers, the burglars at the Watergate. So I think there are six people, some of them led by a guy called Howard Hunt. And the security director was a guy called James McCord, and he was actually a serving CIA official and working as a top security expert, covering the whole of Europe, briefly coming back to the United States. So James McCord it was later realized that he'd done a kind of elementary security mistakes when breaking into this, breaking and entering into the Democrat headquarters, that makes you question. It was probably a deliberate sense of incompetence that they would actually be caught by the police who were doing their rounds. And so, because what happened was, I think that they taped the doors to make it easier to get in and get out again. But and a guard came round and removed the tape, but didn't think that this could be a burglary in progress. But then McCord did exactly the same thing again when he came through again. So, and this time the thick, rather stupid guard couldn't ignore it. He called the police and the police turned up. And it's also been alleged that the police who turned up had been in the area all evening or for an hour at least. So maybe they'd been prepared for this event. It's all a kind of theatrical event to lead these Watergate burglars who are actually doing a sort of stupid break-in, which they didn't really need to do, to ultimately lead us to the doors of the Nixon campaign or to Nixon himself. So, I mean, why would six people with a CIA past be breaking in anyway? I mean, what's going on here? So that, together with the revelation, I think a few years ago, that the Deep Throat guy whose identity, Woodward, carefully kept to himself, was a senior FBI chief called Mark Felt. Anyway, we'll go into news very quickly and we'll carry on after the break. This is Pelle Neroth-Taylor on TNT Radio.
Now, big news, TNT Radio News.
For TNT, this is James O'Neill. The U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit upheld a preliminary injunction against Texas Senate Bill 4, a law designed to arrest and deport suspected illegal immigrants, maintaining a halt on its enforcement. Former President Donald Trump's legal team has informed the U.S. District Court for the Southern District of Florida that a trial date in late May or early June is unfeasible due to a conflicting trial in New York.
The common housefly, caught in the clutches of the spider's web. Every move it makes just makes matters worse. Then, dinner time.
Feast on the captivating stories, videos, and helpful information on our website.
Whoa.
Dinner's ready.
Oh, man.
Escape is futile.
Just one more video.
Get stuck in our web.
TNTradio.live.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on TNT. We're just talking about Watergate. I think Pear's back on again. Are you there, Pear?
Yes. Sorry about that.
Yeah, okay. Well, I mean, just hear me out, because I was telling the audience about what I think is really going on. So, I mean, but basically, these people were, I mean, there's a guy called Mark Lane who wrote, I think, one of the best books about the Kennedy assassination. And Nixon had been interested in the Kennedy assassination. So he was the Kennedy's chief rival from back in 1960, and much more hawkish than Kennedy. Or they're both competing to deal with the communists. But by 1968 or thereabouts, Nixon realized the importance of getting detente with the Russians. So he and Kissinger worked very hard to do that. So although Kissinger was the guy who's famous for bombing Cambodia and authorizing the bombing, Christmas bombings on Vietnam in the Christmas of 1972, he was flying in shuttle traffic to Beijing and Moscow and trying to broker peace with both China and Russia. And he achieved that in the spring of 1972. And I think, I mean, with the Pentagon, actually had to put spies on Kissinger and Nixon, because they didn't know what the president and his secretive national security advisor were doing, because they were very suspicious. They thought Kissinger comes from Central Europe. You know, what is his background? Was he even a communist? Was he a spy working with the Russians? And not many people know that. They think, well, Kissinger is the arch conservative or whatever, but he was a subject of very close interest. And there were a lot of people inside the American security state who did not want detente with the Russians and did not want what Nixon and Kissinger were secretly doing. So Nixon, the whole reason for Nixon's secretiveness was that he had to do this behind the backs of the security state. But I mean, it shows a link to Trump, which we'll maybe get to, is that talking to the Russians or the Soviets back then is absolutely toxic for your reputation or your survival rates in Washington. So, I mean, this Watergate thing, the leader of that team was a spy called Howard Hunt, former CIA then. But he had a past in the CIA. And then this current CIA guy was James McCord, who screwed up deliberately the breaking and entering. Well, Howard Hunt, according to Mark Lane's book on the Kennedy assassination, was the guy who was part of the kill team, you know. And there's a confession by Howard Hunt's son called St. John Hunt. You can Google it, Rolling Stone, Howard Hunt, CIA, murder Kennedy. Confessed on his deathbed that he was a middleman guy. I mean, it was a CIA leadership. Meyer, I think, Cord Meyer and James Jesus Angleton. They were the brains behind the assassination of Kennedy. And Kennedy's problem, of course, was that he wasn't sufficiently anti-communist, as you've worked on. I think you've worked on Hammarskjöld and Kennedy. He was trying to broker peace with Khrushchev after the Cuba crisis. So it seems that every time you talk to the Russians, you get in trouble with the deep state and then try and take you down. And now Trump's trying to do that. Is that something that you'd sign on to, Per?
Well, I think what's interesting is both you and I come from a non-American perspective originally. And I remember in the 1970s as a young boy, listening to Nixon's resignation speech. And I think that the reaction in many places, especially in Europe, was, what the hell are the Americans doing getting rid of Nixon? He was a good person in terms of, as you just mentioned, trying to figure out a way to coexist with the Soviets. And so I think from my perspective, there was always this strange disconnection between Nixon's performance on the world stage and how he was treated domestically.
Hmm. Well, it's interesting because I read, Brezhnev, who was the guy the leader at the time, who was this kind of bear of a man with a kind of Asiatic face and the sort of stock Russian of our collective imaginations with a very stolid appearance. I think he had dementia probably already then. But, I mean, he loved America, and he was taken around America by Nixon, I think, in 1972, and given a car, I think, or something like that. And he was driven around, and he was given six shooters to play with and Western cowboy hats and things. So he loved, and he thought Nixon was the best guy possible. And, in fact, he was Nixon's last ally. He was sending these rather forlorn telegrams after Nixon resigned, or just before he resigned. And so Nixon's last days in office is rather touching, were spent sending telegrams back to his last supporter, which was sitting in the Kremlin, because Brezhnev and he got on very well and they'd broken this détente together. So that's exactly what you're saying, that we couldn't understand why Nixon had to go. I mean, what was the big deal anyway? I mean, do you remember why Nixon was actually impeached? I mean, probably, you know. What's this thing that the American liberals make such a big deal out of?
Well, I guess it was, you know, it was the cover-up, obviously, and then they also added a paragraph in the impeachment because of his what they termed an illegal bombing of Cambodia. But I think another interesting similarity between Trump and Nixon, two other things. Of course, Nixon had just like Trump, pretty much the entire media landscape against him. But of course, unlike Trump, he didn't have any alternative media, no social media to fight back. Can you imagine what the situation would have been like if Nixon had had access to his own Truth Social, if he had backup within his political arena? He was really standing on his own, and he had no support. I remember another story. I interviewed Ehrlichman once. He was Nixon's domestic advisor, who said that Roger Ailes, who at that point had been involved advising Nixon on media strategy, had tried to figure out a way already then how to build an alternative media voice. And of course, they were not able to do that until 1996 when Fox started. So the media landscape is another comparison to Trump, I think, and Nixon. That's interesting. And of course, remember, Nixon used to call the press is the enemy. So I think he was pretty much a precursor to, in many ways, to what Trump is now. And but of course, Trump has an even more of an attack that he has to fight back against now with the legal establishment.
Well, I mean, isn't it the similarity also? I mean, I guess, I mean, in some ways, Trump is sort of fake in the sense that he grew up in New York. I think he's a Democrat for part of his life and is a billionaire and so on. But I mean, people forgive him for that. But Trump represents the little guy, you know, the blue collar worker, in flyover land or whatever. And Nixon's pitch was exactly the same, but it was genuine. I mean, he grew up in a, his parents were grocers. I mean, they owned a grocery store in California or something. And
right.
He always resented these elites, these East Coast elites with their prep school educations looking down on him, you know. And he was also popular. I think he had the best ever election win in November 72, I think, wasn't it? Didn't he win all the states?
Yes,
I mean, it was a massive victory. But of course, I mean, that wasn't a good thing for, in the eyes of the liberals and the intelligence establishment. That was a bad thing in their eyes that this man was so popular. So I think that we need to redefine Nixon in the Trump era. And I think we're too, I was certainly persuaded by people like Hunter Thompson, this cool drug addict, you know, crazy gonzo journalist who had this insane hatred for Nixon. But I never gave a good reason why, I thought. But he had this brilliant cartoonist, Ralph Steadman, working with him. And you think, well, he's a hip guy, he writes well, so, and he hates Nixon. But he didn't actually have any good reasons for it. And I, but Per, I think just to give a final word for you. You were always a fan of Nixon, weren't you? I mean, you from a teen in your teen years, and you've kept up that fascination since. And do you still? How would you summarize Nixon in a couple of phrases before we go into the next guest?
I think he was, as you said, a man who came from very basic, a very basic background, very simple background, who was ambitious and who was dealing with a couple of demons, of course, at the same time. But I think one example shows how he actually was a statesman. In 1960, there were allegations that the election was stolen, remember, against Kennedy. Mm-hmm. And Nixon said, mm-hmm. well, I'm not going to contest it. It's not good for the nation to go through that. He chose mm-hmm. not to. But he might have been able to change that outcome if he had been able to or willing to contest it. And I think that says a lot about Nixon and his statesmanship.
Thank you. And fascinating, maybe he didn't resign in 74 as a result of similar putting the nation first rather than putting it through a struggle. Anyway, Per Colson, thank you very much. Producer for Fox News and Al Jazeera, very well known. Thank you very much. We'll go on to our next guest. This is Pelle Neroth-Taylor on TNT News Talk on this Thursday afternoon.
Military families often sacrifice precious time away from loved ones while serving our country. And for those with children, the separation can be especially difficult.
We were worried that with him leaving, that she would lose those connections with her dad.
Some of life's best moments happen between parents, children, and the pages of a good book. United Through Reading provides that connection.
You can watch your mom or dad read a book to you, and it almost feels like they're really there.
We ensure they remain a consistent, meaningful part of their children's lives, no matter the distance.
Just seeing Jacob recognize Daddy again after a long time just melted my heart.
And now, as we're facing greater isolation from our loved ones, United Through Reading is also available to veterans. Learn more about United Through Reading and download our free secure app at unitedthroughreading.org.
Meet Norm. He lives with anxiety, but with the help of this latest innovation from Be Normal, he can be normal, just like everyone else. With the swipe of a finger, you can project happiness, confidence, machismo. Why settle for being real when you can be normal? The Normal Maker. New from Be Normal.
This item doesn't really work because there's no such thing as normal. We're all different. What we like, how our brains work. In fact, 1 in 5 of us live with mental illness. Don't filter who you are. Start by talking to someone you trust. And remember, there is no normal.
Discussing national and international issues. You're listening to Pelle Neroth-Taylor on today's News Talk TNT.
Welcome back to the Pelle Neroth-Taylor Show on TNT News Talk on this Thursday afternoon. So our final guest today is Kat Canada from Canada, which is a country that ranges from tea shops, the English pubs of Victoria on the West Coast, to the French patisseries of Quebec City, from the golden plains of Alberta to the ice-bound communities of the Inuit North, country that supplies Jordan Peterson, a man with a huge brain, to the surfer dude Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, who is the acme of political correctness. To guide us through the latest development in our friendly country's politics is Kat Canada, who's on the show now. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Kat, I'm intrigued because on your Twitter feed, you've got this short video with Tucker Carlson. You very skillfully edited it because it suggests something terrible going on in Canada and will come to America soon, but you don't actually specify what it is. So that makes it imperative to us to find out what is going on. Why is Canada a warning for what was Tucker Carlson worried about in that short video?
So in the short video, he is referencing the very actually dire situation that's in Canada that's happening, which is when people protest for things they believe in, such as freedom, bodily autonomy during the mandates, they get thrown in prison. They get deemed as dangerous people, and they get persecuted by the government for almost 2 years now. So that's what he was referencing there. It was a case going on in one of the Canadian provinces of Alberta. And he was basically saying, you know, if there's political prisoners in Canada, you know, Canada is very close to the United States, and whatever happens in Canada generally happens in the United States 5 years down the road, which is the point that I was making. And I was saying, you know, there's political prisoners here now. You know, America better watch out, better hang on to your First Amendment rights and your Second Amendment to make sure that this kind of authoritarianism doesn't seep into their country as well. Although, you know, we see some of it happening as well in America, especially during all the J6 trials happening there. Because,
So well, I was going to say, I mean, I talked to a couple of people who were in jail for 6 years in one case and without trial as well. And I think someone was sentenced for 11 years for opposing an abortion clinic and peacefully protesting outside there. But I mean, Canada's definitely got a more authoritarian reputation. And you just have to talk to, but Jordan Peterson, I mean, he's a very outspoken person. I wonder if you're kind of not Jordan Peterson, so it's good to get a second opinion from you. I mean, what's Trudeau like? What's his game? What's he up to? I mean, you know.
Well, you know, thanks. Yeah. So Jordan Peterson, I would say, actually has a quite accurate assessment of this prime minister. He is a narcissist. That's very clear. And he has publicly stated that he admires the basic dictatorship of China. What kind of person who's supposed to be leading a free Western country say that he admires a dictatorship as brutal as the CCP? So that's one thing. And for the rest of this, the rest of Jordan's characterization of Trudeau, I still wholeheartedly agree with. He's inexperienced. He is riding the coattails of his father's name. You know, the thing that backs his experience is being a part-time drama teacher, I think a ski instructor, and just basically loving the limelight. That is the totality of his experience. And he's leading a country like Canada, and he's leading it very ideologically. He's ideologically driven, very hard on the left, very into censorship. He has introduced four censorship bills here in Canada that will regulate the internet, regulate what you can and cannot say, potentially punish you for possible thought crimes with the latest bill, the online harms bill. So Jordan Peterson's description of Trudeau is very accurate.
Just talk a little bit about that online harms bill. I mean, there's something similar that's going on in Scotland, but you can, and we've talked about that in other shows. So that's a topic that interests me. So how far reaching is it? Because thought crime, I mean, that's incredible, isn't it? I mean, it goes against the Western tradition. How can you assess a thought crime?
It goes quite far. It's very sinister. It's very dystopian, very 1984 Orwellian. So from my understanding of the bill and what I've watched, you know, people who are pundits and lawyers go through the wording of the bill, it basically says that at any point in time, anyone can make a complaint against you anonymously for something that you have said in the past online. For any instance, it could be deemed as hate speech. And if you are found guilty of it if they are successful with their complaint against you, you will be responsible for paying $20,000 to the complainant, as well as $50,000 to the government. And if they deem that you are likely to do it again, they could get you on this dystopian, unbelievable thing of potential future hate crimes. Mm-hmm. And it's unbelievable to me that something like this, you know, has support of so many people who claim to be liberal, because as we understand a classic liberal person, they would be for free speech. But now there's so many things you can't say. There's so many terms that you could get, you know, come after for. It's scary.
I mean, so let's try and bring it down to a concrete level. You make a comment on Twitter, and it's still, presumably they have to provide proof that you've made that comment. I mean, it can't be deleted or anything. And the hate is in the eye of the beholder. It doesn't need a victim to complain. It could say, you make a joke about, I don't know, Irish people. And an Irish person doesn't feel offended. No Irish person's come forward or whatever. But let's say another person says, well, that's offensive to Irish people, you know. And it might not even have been intended to be offensive. It might be just a kind of random comment about something. But he says, he's made a joke and he's offensive to Irish people in that remark. And I perceive it to be so. That doesn't have to be intent on your behalf or in the receiver's mind. It's in any random person's mind. And that could cause a prosecution. And of course, and it's the accuser gets compensated. So, I mean, that's a massive recipe for people who out of money to go around accusing all kinds of people and getting paid for it. Is that right? Have I interpreted that right?
Exactly. Yeah. So there is no limit on to what they can come after you for. Anything that you have said online in the past, they can come after every single one. And a lot of the people who analyze this thing and look at it in detail, the pundits, Jordan Peterson as well, this bill is seen by some of the people as basically a kill bill of independent free press, because anyone at any time can come and say, well, this article offended me, or what you said here offended me. And it can be, like I said, the complainant can remain anonymous, and there's no limit to the complaints that they can make. So that is basically lawfare to silence people like Jordan Peterson, who criticized Trudeau heavily, for independent conservative media outlets who criticize Trudeau heavily and, you know, criticize the wokeness aspect of Canada quite heavily. So it just seems like a bill that's come, that's being rammed down the throats of Canadians to scare them into silence, because the legislation is quite scary, as I outlined the possible repercussions. And I didn't even mention the fact that it's possible to go to prison as well, not just the fines. The outrageous, ridiculous fines, but prison time.
So presumably somebody, a narcissist or a psychopath or just somebody who's broke, could sit at their computer all day long sending out emails to the police or whatever it is when they feel offended by something. And they can maybe send out 100 emails a day, and it's all anonymous. And one of them bites, as it were, and they suddenly they've won bingo, you know, they've won the jackpot. Somebody get money in. It sounds incredible, but what stage of the legislation is it at? I mean, has it the parliament and you've got two chambers, I think?
I'm not quite certain on that. I know the details of the bill. It's kind of dropped off my radar recently to see how far along it has come. But, you know, the several bills that he's pushed through before have come into effect. So I'm not sure where the bill is at. So pardon me for not being quite up to date for it. But I know that one of his censorship bills has been rammed through. And because of it, now people can't access news links on social media, like the Meta platforms. So Facebook and Instagram, you can no longer share news links that lead to Canadian news articles because of his censorship legislation. You just get this error screen, cannot access account or something like that. So
is that on any topic or on kind of controversial topics?
Any topic, no links. So if you want news links, you can only be on Twitter, or formerly known as Twitter X at this point.
Yeah. And do you, as a conservative commentator, feel under threat at all? Are you afraid?
Afraid? Well, I have concerns, because what I say online would be considered, you know, wrong think by the hard leftists like Trudeau and his ilk. But, you know, at this point, coming from a communist country, fleeing a communist country to come to Canada, my parents gave up everything to us here. Does that fear stop me from speaking my mind as of right now? No. Because I want to be able to say that I did not back down, and I did not, you know, let fear control my tongue and what I have to say.
Which East European country did your family come from?
The Soviet Union.
So, I mean, are your parents in Canada now?
My mom, yeah.
I can't judge, but I mean, do you remember your parents or your mom able to make any comparisons between the Soviet bloc and its freedom or anti-freedom and Canada? Because I know some people who are dissidents in this old Soviet Union come to the West and say, you're going down our route, stop it. You know, we fought for freedom and you're going down completely the wrong way now.
So, yes. Yeah, so when I inform my mom about what's happening, because she's not online, she, you know, she's not up to date on anything, you know, she's in her older years, that doesn't really fuss her anymore. But when I sometimes share the news about the latest, you know, dystopian thing that's happening in Canada, she just shakes her head and goes insane, crazy, and completely agrees with me that it's so echoing of the things that went on in the Soviet Union when we were there. You couldn't speak out against the government, you'd get disappeared real quick, you know, all the things.
Well, it's interesting. There's a guy who hosts the show, a friend of mine also, a guy called Dirk Puhlmann, and he lives in Berlin. And, you know, Berlin obviously is a combination of East and West Berlin. And so there are a lot of people who grew up in East Germany, a lot of people in journalism today. And they say, well, to be honest, you know, late stage communism, 1980s, it was kind of semi-free or people didn't get sent to gulags, but they lost their jobs. And the intellectual climate in today's Germany is approximately like that of East Germany in 1983. And that really makes you think, doesn't it? Because here we were fighting against that for the entire Cold War, and we're becoming the same without a shot being fired. Anyway, but you hear about these Canadian truckers who are supposed to stand up for freedom. But what happened there? Are they still a force to be reckoned with?
Well, they put on quite a fight, I would say. We were there. I personally wasn't there, but although I was glued to my screen 24/7 to see the latest developments, they did a really good job. And although the tyrant in our prime minister's chair did pass the Emergencies Act to deal with the truckers, shortly after that, a lot of the mandates that were in place were dropped. So even though the boot came down on these brave men who came to fight for freedom in our capital, that didn't stop, you know, the politicians kind of backing down and rescinding some of the harsh mandates. Because myself, I couldn't travel in the country for 6 months. I couldn't attend a movie theater. I couldn't attend a restaurant. It was absurd. And so the boys went down there. They were peaceful the entire time, despite the smear job by the dying legacy media. They were there for 3 weeks, I believe. And after that, things started crumbling for the establishment. People who loved the lockdowns and the mandates and who pushed all that authoritarian stuff during that time.
So we've only got 2 minutes left, Kat Canada, but is there a chance to boot out this narcissist? I mean, when are the next elections and what are his prospects for winning?
Right. So the next election, as we all conservatives feel, can't come soon enough, but it is coming. It's about 18 months away, and the leader of the opposition that is now catapulted to just absolutely dominate in that election, Pierre Poilievre, he's doing a really good job campaigning across the country. In fact, I'm going to one of his rallies on Monday. So it's looking good for the leader of the opposition, and funnily enough, the Liberals have sunk so deep in the polls under Trudeau that there's even a chance of them losing official opposition party status in the next election. So if we're on the trajectory that we are now, with Poilievre leading the movement so strongly and leading in the polls over and over, just crushing and dominating the polls, there's a really good chance of us finally giving this guy the boot in 2025.
Thank you very much for that, Kat. It seems as if Canada is very sick of this political correctness and wokeness. And in the UK, we're seeing the Tories, who've been ruling for a long time, on their way out. And it's similar in Canada, except it's the Liberals who are the ruling party, and they're on their way out. Thank you very much, Kat Canada. You can find her on Twitter. This is Pelle Nerroth Taylor's show on this Thursday afternoon. Thank you very much.